One, two, three, four.
I want to live a life of consequence, and I want to live a life that has stakes in it, because that means that things matter to you. I think in some ways this memoir was a project of sifting through and excavating the darkest hours, both for me and for the lineage and the ancestry that I came from. I think the darkest hours were, you know, so many people that I come from have had to leave places they didn't want to leave, have been forced to leave behind houses and land and cities and people, and oftentimes have had it happen more than once in a lifetime, and so have carried that trauma. And then, of course, it plays out intergenerationally in all these different ways. I think it's a time of fear. I don't think I'm alone in that. I think I'm scared for people that I love. I'm scared for people that are quite vulnerable. I'm scared for my students. I worry for the people in the spaces that are most vulnerable. I worry for the places that I feel like are engaging in complicity, because that is going to be such a heavy legacy to endure later on. How people and places and entities comport themselves in moments like this are, they'll be remembered. There will always be people that remember it.
Hala Alian is the author of the memoir, I'll Tell You When I'm Home. The novels, Salt Houses, winner of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize and the Arab American Book Award, and a finalist for the Chautauqua Prize, and The Arsonist City, a finalist for the Aspen Words Literary Prize. She is also the author of 5 highly acclaimed collections of poetry, including The 29th Year and The Moon That Turns You Back. Her work has been published in The New Yorker, The Academy of American Poets, The New York Times, The Guardian, and Guernica. She lives in Brooklyn with her family, where she works as a clinical psychologist and professor at New York University.
Hala Alian, welcome back to The Creative Process.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be back.
So I've just finished reading your memoir, I'll Tell You When I'm Home, and I think it's just so beautiful. I think before we dive into the conversation, I believe you've selected a passage that you'd like to share with our listeners.
I have. I'm actually going to just read from the beginning, and we'll just do cold open. The month is May. It is 1948. A girl named Siham is 15 years old. Her village is Al-Majdan. She lives in a seaside house with her siblings. Her father travels for months at a time, buying and selling textiles and garments to other coastal towns and villages. 200 miles to the north, in Damascus, a girl named Fatma lives in a house with marble floors and a courtyard filled with basil and oleander plants. Fatma is the middle daughter, the daughter of a sheikh, a man of God who will stop speaking with her when she elopes with a stranger in 12 years. Fatma wears her hair short and bobbed, speaks French, will have 3 daughters, but only 2 will live. She will leave Syria in a decade. Siham will leave Al-Majdal this month, this week, tonight. What does she pack? A dress, a notebook of dried flowers. Her family will live in a house in a new town, in a neighborhood in Gaza, Harit al-Dalaj, the neighborhood of stairs. They will be the lucky ones. When Siham marries, it will be a man from the camps. She will have son after son after son, an army of sons, 6 of them, and only 1 daughter. Siham will leave Al-Majdal tonight. She will leave, and there will be a crescent moon or half moon or no moon. She will leave, and the soldiers' voices will fill the street and sea and sky. She will never stop hearing them. They brace themselves to leave. For the length of a dirt-packed road, the burning rubber of airplane tires, a new city, then another. These 2 women, not yet mothers, not yet my grandmothers. It will be 38 years before they meet in Kuwait, their adopted home, their children marrying, the wedding in the banquet hall of the Holiday Inn Hotel in Kuwait City, both the groom and bride wearing white. Another 5 years before all that too is gone, before one stays, the other leaves. The Palestinian one will be buried in Syrian soil, the Syrian one in Lebanese soil. More than 70 years later, I wake from anesthesia.
Yes. Well, it's just this book, this memoir is full of leavings and arrivals and meditations on what is home, you know, when it's no longer linked to land, but to stories and memories, which we lose over time, and language that we lose over time. And, you know, for those who are now going to now read your book, it's not yet come out, so I to get an early copy. It comes out in June. You recount very candidly, very openly, your journey to becoming a mother. This was a longer journey towards motherhood than, you know, is something you really fought for.
Yeah, I think that it was longer both in terms of time, and I think it was also like in the sense that there were just more steps involved in it. It required expanding my resources in many ways, but including internal resources and resources even of imagination. It required kind of pushing my imagination of my understanding of what made a family and what makes a mother and how someone can arrive at parenthood. I had many years of wanting and trying to have a kid. I had a lot of miscarriages. I ended up having an ectopic. It was a period of time where my body was very medicalized. Like I was sort of in and out of medical systems to get my body to do something that it, you know, quote, was supposed to do, end quote. And really experiencing coming up against the limitations of what my body could do on a regular basis. And then kind of having to, again, just like really get imaginative. And I really think of it as that, as like it had to be sort of an exercise of imagination of like, what are the other ways that we can arrive here? What are the other avenues that are possible for us? In my case, I have like a wonky shaped uterus. So I sort of have a uterus that's shaped kind of like a heart, which the poet in me liked, but made it difficult to carry to term. So I could get pregnant very easily, but it was hard to carry past a certain amount of time. Meanwhile, my eggs were fine. And so I was able to make embryos that were biologically mine, but I just kind of couldn't be the house for them in any sort of meaningful way. And so then the question became, what other house may I find for them? And that's when we kind of arrived at surrogacy.
It's interesting. As you say, the poet in you unifies these links. It reminds me again, thinking about home and exile. It's your child, but in another home. You are still yourself. Yes. And I want to just follow up on the passage that you read, because at once this is your journey towards finally meeting Layla, your child that you have written to many times before you met you. She was always as a kernel. And I do want to touch on, for those who don't know, who didn't hear the first time you came on our show, you referenced there in the passage that you read your grandmother's, your whole, you know, you live in so many places, your family coming from, you know, countries in the Middle East. And maybe you should describe it. I mean, there's a passage you write, I'm a Palestinian American, but maybe you want to.
Yeah, of course. My mother, I mean, I would say so my father's family is Palestinian, and they were both his mother and father, so both grandparents, were from villages that were essentially eradicated and depopulated in 48. And then they went to Gaza. And that's where my grandparents met. That's where my father was born. That's where they, even after they moved to Kuwait, the family would kind of go back and forth until 1967. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, my father, while spending summers there, really was essentially raised in Kuwait. That's where he then met my mother. And my mother on her maternal side is Syrian and then is Lebanese, essentially, with her father also having lived in, you know, it's interesting. And I think I do talk about this in the book, like how that part of the world, so much of it, you know, a lot of the bordering and reshuffling of land and what was named what was done at the behest of essentially the colonizers. And so it's really interesting how we kind of create these false delineations. But for all intents and purposes, my mom and father left and met in Kuwait and then, you know, left during the invasion. And so by the time Saddam had invaded in 1990 and I just turned 4, that was one of several displacements at that point that their families had already experienced.
Yes. And so it's so moving, the written, and it really brings in all your grandparents, and you really show how important family is for you. Yeah. And you talk about this storytelling process as well, likening yourself to Shahrazad. And I like that so much, because also you said that Layla, I didn't know, means night, and you name her for all the stories that can change when you're not even looking. I'm just quoting you, in the darkest hours. Right. So, you know, what for you were those darkest hours, and what stories, you know, changed for you and them?
I think in some ways this memoir was a project of sifting through and excavating the darkest hours, both for me and for the lineage and the ancestry that I came from. It's, I think the darkest hours were, you know, so many people that I come from have had to leave places they didn't want to leave, have been forced to leave behind houses and land and cities and people, and oftentimes have had it happen more than once in a lifetime. And so have carried that trauma. And then, of course, it plays out intergenerationally in all these different ways. And then I think for me, there's from my little branch of that family tree, my darkest hours involved a lot of, again, there was a lot of like warring with the body. I think I realized as I was writing this book that like the body was sort of the original site of where the story started, because it was about, you know, kind of fertility, pregnancy, et cetera. And then in trying to tell the story of the land, I couldn't tell the story of the land without telling the story of the body. And I couldn't tell the story of the body without telling the story of the people that had made the body and all these ways in which I had felt exiled from the body. And so for me, it has a lot to do with stories of eating disorders. It has a lot to do with stories of addiction, of alcoholism, of what it meant to feel kind of like an unwanted guest in my own body, and then really trying to think of ways to sort of reclaim that. And I'm really coming to think of it as like the task of a lifetime. I don't know that there's a capital A arrival that happens. I think it's just something that I'm going to keep figuring out as time goes on. And I don't think it's disconnected from larger patterns of exile. I mean, I think when you belong to identity markers where you are told there is not a place for you in the world, or the places that are yours are not yours, I do think that trickles down to, yeah, where then are you at home? Are you at home in your body? Are you at home in this host country? Are you at home in this? Like, I mean, I think there's a way in which that it plays out in all these different ways.
Yeah, I think so. And the last time we spoke, you had said to me, and it's kind of profound to think of it, is that in Palestine, mm-hmm. Gaza, people can't have PTSD because the trauma has
exactly
not
passed. Right.
And so in some ways, it, you know, we, and particularly I think, you know, even more so as women, but just humans store our anxiety in our body. It's, you know, you can work it out in your mind, you can tell it in stories to get it out of, but something in you is unsettled, you know. And there's no doubt there is that connection between mind and body. You write that I have remade myself many times. And I'm just wondering, how did, you know, as you're writing this, you were obviously changing. So how do you reconcile that self that writes, the self that remembers, the self that mothers, you know?
Of course, yeah. I mean, I think I've come to reconcile it by accepting the fact that it's going to constantly be in flux. You know, there's such a great freedom in being able to say what I hold and what I say and how I feel today might be different tomorrow, and might be different in a week, and it might be different in 10 years, and it likely will be. And, you know, it's really interesting. I think I sometimes can struggle with the purity of something, like in seeking truth, like what is the truthiest truth that I can find? And I think something that I hope to make peace with in my lifetime is this idea that it doesn't make a thing any less true just because it's changed. You know, it doesn't make the version of you that believed or really fully was embodied in a narrative. Just if that narrative changed, it doesn't discount the self that lived there. And so for me, I think that's how I make peace with like the self that writes and makes sense of something. Of course, the story is going to be different. My story is already different. I was writing about in the course of this memoir, a marriage that I was very much hoping would be able to sustain itself. And I'm currently going through a divorce. So even the marriage that I wrote about in this story, by the time this book is out, has essentially dissolved. And so what do you do then with that? You know, like does that make the marriage any less true? Does that make the story of certain elements of its love or its truth any less valid? I don't think so. I think we're just constantly in this process of editing and re-editing and repositioning sense of ourselves and other people. I do think that's the work of a lifetime. So it's incredibly unsatisfying for a perfectionist or someone that likes control, which I love control, or at least I tell myself I love control, but it doesn't make it any less real.
I'm sure you came to the right, because there's a lot of tenderness for Johnny, I guess.
Yes, so I think there is. I think the tenderness and the love with which those elements of the story were told aren't any less true, you know? Like, I actually think they in some ways, I think that probably became even more true because I got the chance to tell the story in a way. Like, I think I felt and still feel, and hopefully that continues, like so much less resentment for so many things that, you know, that includes the story of the marriage, that includes stories of exile. Like, I think there was something in the telling that felt liberatory, actually.
Yeah, exactly. And going back to Shahrazad, you know, you talk about her, you know, her cunning and her survival. And then you ask, what stories would she have told if she wasn't trying to survive, but to live? So you're talking about coming into this period of freedom and love.
Right.
Do you feel now that you're writing, I mean, what you're working on now, but from a place of it's beyond survival, it's now something closer to freedom?
What a beautiful question. I think so. I hope so. You know, I'd like to believe so. I definitely think there was something in this project that was unlike anything else I've worked on before, in that it was, well, first of all, nonfiction. It's the first long form nonfiction thing I've done. But I do think there was something liberatory about being like, there's nowhere to hide. When I say I in a poem, I can always just say that's the speaker, that's the subject. We don't know that that's what I thought, you know. Whereas like in a memoir, you're essentially saying in the title, like, you know, this is memoirs, like from the word memory in French, it's like, this is my memory. This is me that is remembering and putting this together and telling you the story. And there's just nowhere to hide in that. And I think while that's very terrifying, there is something, like most things that are scary, there's something freeing about it too. For me, there's, yeah, it's kind of changed my relationship to how I conceptualize sort of these things in ways that I feel like are, it's unlike anything I've ever worked on in my life, because it forced me to have to confront my, not just my memories and my recollection of things, but also just what is truly my commitment to the truth here, you know, even if that truth is, what happens if that truth actually doesn't sit well with me? What happens if my truth is contradicted by someone else's truth, which happens all the time, you know? It's been very painful, but I really wouldn't trade it for anything.
There's obviously, there's more than one truth. And you know that as a psychotherapist. And it's difficult because while you're telling your truth, you're also telling somebody else's truth. And maybe they prefer to tell their story. But you do it in such a way that's poetic. So I never felt it's like invasive of anyone else's story. And then also in your novels and in your poetry, you were talking about family and it had a very personal feel to it. But it's when it's memoir, it's something else, like the commitment to truth.
It's different. It is different. I think that's been something that I've really kind of had to reckon with, is this idea of like, what does it mean to tell someone else's story, you know, is really scary. Because I think absolutely people, it's very possible and almost definitely will happen where people will read some element of this and see themselves in it, or they will have been either part of the story or have been around the story and will say, well, no, that's not really how I recall it happening. And that's okay too. You know what I mean? Like having to allow that to also be possible is really, it's very scary for me.
Yeah. But there's just so much love and tenderness throughout. Mm. And you're writing this, we have to remind ourselves because we can forget the trauma of what was COVID, what was going on in the world. Describe those years and what was going on in the world as you're, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, I was in New York. It happened to overlap with me with a lot of the infertility stuff, actually, unfortunately. So it's interesting because it was kind of a horrible time collectively, as it was for everybody. And then it was also, there was kind of singularly this horror to a lot of it that was really, I remember feeling quite selfish during that time because I would sort of be like, trying to remind myself that I wasn't alone in the world. I would try to be like, well, remember, you know, you're in this thing with all these other people. And I was just so lost in my own misery, I think, the way that we all are sometimes in different chapters of our life, because I was just so, I was trying to get pregnant. I was, again, failing and failing was how I kept conceptualizing it to myself. And I just couldn't find a way to make it make sense because I had never, I think there's also something about like, I had never tried so hard at something before. And the fact that I couldn't get it to work was really maddening in this way that, I mean, logically, of course, you understand, like, you know, this isn't about trying and it's not some moral failing or anything, but I was just trying so hard and the thing wasn't happening. And it was against the backdrop of just all of this loss and all of this death. And then simultaneously, there were all these things that were happening in that. So the year of COVID and the year after, the port explosion in Lebanon, my grandfather dying, just not being able to see him or access him before he passed. And then 2021, like seeing, you know, Sheikh Jarrah, things happening, like it just was like, there was just something about like, as I was trying to bring another life into the world, really having to sort of ask myself what that even meant to be bringing another life and what it would mean in terms of like what you could pass on to a child, when a lot of the people and places that were for me such massive markers of, you know, whose identity were gone.
Yeah. And then, of course, since then, you have had this beautiful blessing in your life. But then we see, of course, in the war on Gaza.
Yes, of course.
It's just so, I mean, it's sad. Pope Francis just passed and his last Easter message was, you know, this is the devastating situation. And I don't.
Absolutely, it needs to be named. I mean, I think, like, for me, so much of it is the what it has meant to parent and mother and love in a time when you're watching the kind of horrific devastation and slaughter and starvation, like, you know, children being amputated, children being murdered, like, in these incredibly haunting and relentless ways. I think this is horrific to witness, to bear witness to, period, no matter what. It doesn't really matter. You don't need to be in relation to other people to find it horrific. But there has been, for me, I'll speak just for myself, there's been an additional thing of just trying to mother and parent through it and just really thinking about just how incredibly helpless and powerless so many people are, not by virtue of some innate trait of theirs that makes them helpless and powerless, but because they are made to be helpless and powerless, is just, it's incredibly difficult to process.
Yes. And during this time, you written powerful and moving editorials. I was moved by you just telling the truth, just saying this is, you know, the children who maybe they don't even have parents, their family is gone. Yeah. Just protect us, you know, to imagine having to find your voice at such an age. And it's very distressing. And of course, you're in New York, but I do have to mention it because we now see with the Trump presidency and the attack on universities, and you teach at NYU. And I don't like people speaking up for the human rights are being told that they're Hamas lovers or something, when it's actually just, you know, pro-human rights. Just take it away from, you know, what side you're on. It's just pro-human rights. And I think that that has to be said. And if that could be put across, but, you know, again, this is a whole
I think that it's almost like in some ways the specificity of Palestine also becomes kind of a universality, where it's sort of like you can stay in this specific example because there is something about this experience that makes it specific, right? It's happening because it's been sanctioned to happen in this way, right? Because it is not possible to slaughter tens of thousands of people without consequence unless you have made those people less than people, unless there has been a very effective project of dehumanization that's been carried out against the people that are being killed, right? And so in that way, it's very specific. But I think, yeah, absolutely, to your point, the universality of it is just like, well, I mean, you change what it means for a child to be killed if that child, what we mean by the sanctity of life, you know? And the thing is, again, I try to stay away from the, like, you know, people should care about this because it will impact them. People should care about this because they should care about it. But fine, just to go down that road for a second. And then when you do that, you've changed it for everybody, actually. You know, it you may not think you have, and you may think that it remains kind of confined to that group of people, but it doesn't. You set new precedents, and then those precedents will rarely be confined to the example that birthed them, you know?
Exactly. And we've seen it from the one good thing is that it's just changed. The spark of conscience is changing. It's become more, there's a greater global awareness. I mean, I've seen, I'm part Irish, and we saw how in Ireland, politicians that, you know, they had their 800 years of occupation, and it shouldn't be acceptable. This shouldn't be something that we have now. So I think it's changing, but it's just tragic that it's the cost of lives.
What will cost for the changes.
So but I think, you know, bringing it back to the personal life, because we can care about the individual. So what you do in this memoir and your novels and poetry, that makes it something, you know, a book is something you can hold in your hand, you can feel close to it, and it gets into your mind, and that changes people in very, very many soft and subtle ways.
I certainly hope so. I mean, I think that's very much kind of how I've always operated with it's. This is in some ways just kind of what I have at my disposal, is the ability to tell stories in this way. And so it's effective for me, you know what I mean? And so, like, that's how I've changed my mind about things. That's how I've learned about things. That's how I've understood things differently in the world. The hope is that everyone shows up for these moments historically with what we have in our arsenal that we have access to. I'm a psychologist and I'm a storyteller. And so I'm going to use what I can to try to do the work that I can. Again, with the hope that that will be effective. We don't know. We'll see. But I do think there's something to be said for just like you show up with what you have. You just hope that that's enough. And sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. And I think anytime there's as much at stake as there is right now, it's always going to feel like it's not enough, which is certainly how it feels now. But yeah, the privilege of having some degree of safety or separateness is that you use that safety and separateness, hopefully, in helping others and showing up for others. That's kind of the ideal. And people who have access to certain spaces should be using them in the service of people that don't, is, again, just a general philosophy that I have. It's outside of, I mean, certainly contained within this moment, but outside of it as well.
Yeah. And so I was also wondering, throughout your memoir, you address your daughter, and particularly in the ending, you make it clear that this is a story that you want her to inherit. Could you elaborate on what it means to give your daughter such a vulnerable look into who you are and how she came to be?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I didn't really set out to write this book, I think is kind of an interesting framing of it, is this book was intended initially to be a collection of essays that were kind of vague and just sort of like some about exile, some about philosophical topics and psychological conversations, etc. And then it was also kind of unfolding as a lot of this stuff was happening, and it started to go more in this personal writing direction. As I was doing it, that was one of the big questions that I had for myself, was like, is this something that I'm going to regret? Is this something that I want out in the world? What does this mean for a child at some point to be able to read, you know, like a lot of details about their parents' life? It's certainly different than, I mean, I've in some ways the opposite, like I kind of have to prize stories from my mother. And I think that I really have tried to handle the subject matter with as much grace and mindfulness as I can, with an understanding that not just she might read it someday, but that like other people in my life, in my family, other people that are involved in different ways might read it. So there was in general kind of like the trying to be aware of how to do this with as much tenderness and mindfulness as possible for everybody involved. I have no idea how it will land. I think with kids in some way, no matter what direction you go in, there's going to be consequences. You know what I mean? If a kid doesn't have access to those parts of you, that's going to play out in a certain way. If they have too much access to your inner world, that also becomes a problem. Like, you know, I've certainly tried to write it so that I can answer to anything. If she were to ever read it someday, that I'm comfortable speaking to anything that's in there. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, she's, you know, someday a teenager, inshallah, I might completely regret that I did this. I have no idea.
No, it's very, I mean, if it's very, I couldn't think of a more tender piece of writing and full of hope and love. Mm-hmm. It's interesting you mentioned that you have to prize stories out of your mother. And I think that when there's a lot of trauma or a lot of moving or things. Yes. So, you know, and then you write about also, you know, the stories, the songs, or even the rituals or the food or the customs. Mm. How do you feel like sometimes stories are embedded in these things and you have to kind of like the kind of mystery puzzles to find out what really happened?
I think I've had to a little bit. I mean, I definitely feel like there's been a little bit of that for me where I'm just like, how can I get what I need to get? I mean, I also, it's very funny because I think my mom is a pretty private person. And I think she really did essentially just at some point say, like, you're on a stories embargo. Like, I'm done. I'm not going to tell you anymore. I don't want you to write about any of this. So I think my mom in particular is somebody who I think has sort of like, I think she struggles with the idea that I write about any of this stuff. Which I understand. I really do. I get it. I mean, I think there's also something to be said for, you know, a certain kind of silence and privacy also historically is associated with safety too, you know? And so I think for some people, there is this idea of like, why would you even expose yourself in any way, you know? Like, even if you're doing it with kindness or sweetness or consideration, like just why would we even take these chances? I think that's also like the thing of the writer or the artist in general versus other people. It's like there is kind of almost like a compulsion to be known, you know, or a compulsion to be able to tell a thing that is definitely not something that everybody has. And I think it's like just as hard as it is for me to understand how someone wouldn't have that, it's just as hard for another person to be like, why do you even need to tell any of this stuff? I think it's been, I think that's been an interesting thing with my mother and me. It's kind of like finding a way to arrive at together this thing that we're just like, well, I guess we just sort of need different things, you know?
And definitely generationally, and for some people, even forgetting is a kind of healing.
Absolutely. And safety. Healing, and it's a kind of safety, you know? Why would we keep reopening the thing? You know, you can let the past be in the past. I think that's very much a way that people have survived so many things. And again, who am I to, like, it's very easy to pretend that one way is better than another, you know what I mean? Or it's like, well, no, this is more honest, or I'm more, it's like, but not really, you know, that's just how it's the way that comes more naturally to me. That's all. I was born in the States. I was born with certain, with different kinds of privileges. I was born in between two cultures. I think there's a lot of elements of it that play into it.
And on that note of survival, from the front of your book, you have some quotes. I do not see in this night other than the end of this night by Darwish, and Imagine You Must Survive Without Running by Ada Limon. Could you explain what these mean to you?
The two, I mean, it opens with the Darwish quote, and then almost in response to that is the Ada Limon quote. And they both are, yeah, I mean, they're both sort of playing with themes of night and endurance, and like, how, what do we survive and how do we survive it? And what does it mean if we are going to survive things without certain tools, you know, or access to certain things? The book is about, you know, it's kind of, how do we make it to the morning and how do we survive to be able to tell these things? And to the question you asked sort of in the beginning, like, what would we tell if this weren't about survival? You know, imagine you're able to tell stories without everything hinging on them, or everything hinging on them being told in a particular way. What stories would you tell then? I find that question to be really interesting. I ask myself some version of it often, you know, and I don't have an answer, like, because I can't even imagine it, of like, what would I do with my life if I didn't have to constantly keep bearing witness to certain things so that I may find ways to keep them alive in the imagination and in discourse.
Yeah, well, I can imagine that there are any artists, and it's sad to think it's true, but they haven't experienced some kind of trauma. Yeah. Or struggle.
I mean, yeah, totally.
You know, I don't know, like, what if you had the perfectly happy, perfectly pampered, why would you be writing?
What's the point? What's the point?
It's all future for you.
That's very funny. I do wonder how much of it is like, or it's like, or puzzling through, because I think even if you didn't have something difficult happen, how much of it is just about making sense of things? You know, like, I think there's something in that too that we maybe don't talk about enough. So much of art making is really just about trying to understand and make fragmented things cohere and make sense and find cohesion within them. And so that would happen even if you had a quote easy, you know what I mean? Like, even if things weren't all, like, I would imagine you would still be finding yourself wanting to do that even if there wasn't some, you know, big capital T trauma that had happened. Life is a lot, period.
It's, if you're paying attention.
It's a lot, you know? Yeah. It's joy will break your heart. Love will break your heart, you know? Mm-hmm. Even the things that we ascribe sort of like positive valence to, it's still like, it's a tremendous amount.
Yeah, and I often think, I mean, when you think about the struggle, it's, when we're in the middle of it, it's hard to see the end, and we're just right. Trying to keep moving as fast as we can and to get through to it. When you look at in the animal
Absolutely.
World, that's it.
Absolutely.
That's when they run the fastest. That's when they fly the right. highest.
Right.
Because their life depended on it, really.
That's right. And that's such a, I mean, it's so painful, right? You don't want that to be the truth, but it is. I mean, it's stakes. Life without stakes is a I don't know that anyone would want it. And that doesn't mean that you want to like really be out here suffering 24/7. But I think there's something about like, I want to live a life of consequence, and I want to live a life that has stakes in it. And I want to believe that because that means that things matter to you. And it's so much less painful to live in a way where things don't matter, but it's just, it also feels so much, I don't know. I think it would feel a little bit more hollow too.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, so much is at stake now, and I wonder what it's like, you know, being a Palestinian American for you today, you know, I mean, what is the atmosphere there? Obviously you've spoken out and you've written these public editorials and, you know, essays that, but what is that like? And you also wrote about not always being able to travel to see your different family. What are you feeling like now? I mean, this presidency isn't easy.
No, it's not. I mean, I think it's a time of fear. I don't think I'm alone in that. I think I'm scared for people that I love. I'm scared for people that are quite vulnerable. I'm scared for my students. I'm scared for a lot of international students. There's a lot of international folks that I work with, international folks that I love. I think there's a lot of people who I worry about. It's like, I worry for the people in the spaces that are most vulnerable. I worry for the places that I feel like are engaging in complicity, because that is going to be such a heavy legacy to endure later on. How people and places and entities comport themselves in moments like this are they'll be remembered. There will always be people that remember it. And so I'm kind of two minds because I understand what fear does. It contracts. It makes you not want to take risks. It makes you want to get really insular and be like, I need to protect myself and mine and my people and my, that's it, my little bubble. And whatever happens outside of that is none of my business. And it's really difficult in times of fear to stay open and to remember that we are really interconnected. That, I mean, this whole idea of like, what's happening to children over there isn't affecting my children over here. And it's like, there is no such thing as children over there. There really isn't. There is no such thing as, you know, this idea of like someone else's kid. And I think when you really drop into that, it's a lot to take in, and it can be haunting in a very different way. So I can understand why people turn away from that sort of thinking. But yeah, I mean, I worry about all of it. You know, I worry about, again, the precedents that are being set, what's going to happen next, what's already happened. And I think also international, like, I think it's easy to, like, I think, you know, we here can get really Americentric. But I think, like, also, what are the consequences of what's happening here across the world? The same way that what were the consequences of things that were happening over there, over here? It's all so deeply entwined. And I think people are starting to really see that. And yeah, it means that, like, what you do in your own backyard really is of consequence everywhere. So yeah, it's an unsettling time.
My name is Natalie McCarthy, and I'm a rising junior at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill studying English and journalism. Getting the chance to read Hala Alian's memoir has been so incredible. She's a brave and powerful storyteller, and not only is this book beautiful and hopeful as it deals with incredibly relevant and important matters, but there's also a sort of meta aspect to it that illuminates what storytelling means and what it does for us. I'm reminded of the famous Joan Didion quote, "We tell ourselves stories in order to live." And what she means here is that we want to find some thread of coherence in the midst of our often crazy and absurd lives. I think Hala Alian embodies this beautifully as she traces her life as both a product of displacement and also as a current subject to displacement, and not only from land, but also from her own body. In her memoir, she talks about storytelling in a really interesting way, kind of saying that as we tell ourselves stories, we create something distinct from ourselves. It's almost like embalming and entombing our most difficult moments. And this isn't an act of stifling, but it's an act of respect and also of separation. She also probes us to wonder about what we might create when we're not in survival mode. And I think it's so brilliant how she explores what writing and art does for us and what forces push us to create. My studies at school concentrate in creative nonfiction writing, and once in a class, we were discussing what emotions we think are most fitting for memoir and essay writing. And almost unanimously, we decided that things like love and pure joy often don't make for the best essays because they're too pure and unchallenging, maybe not conducive to the sense of excavation and analysis we usually see in essays. But we decided that things like resentment or pain can be more appropriate. And I think that there may still be some truth there, that this is a genre that feels like it demands for a complication to be sorted through. But the exploration of storytelling in I'll Tell You When I'm Home has made me wonder if maybe there's a side to us that wants and needs to write about pure things like joy and love, and what it might look like for people to get their head above the water for a moment to pursue that. And now, back to the interview.
One thing that I was glad to see is the number of nations speaking at the United Nations and understanding, you know, America's and Israel's. They're actually in such a minority and have been for a long time, but just to see that public outcry, and I would like to see, obviously, that backed up. And it's very hard to think of, I don't know what pacifist solutions are. I mean, I don't like to solve conflict with more militarization. It's something that we have to hope for and hold on to.
Right.
And I don't need to tell you about that. And so I want to ask about technology and AI and how this is changing the way we communicate with ourselves. You know, someone who's a psychotherapist, as a writer who's so much into the interpersonal communication, I don't know what your reflections are on that and the way it's changing us in kind of strange, weird, wonderful ways.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm not a very tech savvy, tech forward person. I think I get really overwhelmed at the prospect of technology. And so I think for someone like me, the initial reaction is like one of contraction and just one where I'm like, I actually don't even want to take that on. It just sort of spooks me a little bit. But I think kind of when I dive into it a little bit more existentially or philosophically, it continues to spook me just in a different way. I come back to this idea of accountability and regulation and really thinking through consequences. Like, I think my foray into it is pretty 101. I wish I felt a little bit more excited about it or hopeful or interested in the ways it can be used collaboratively. Everything I've read has felt pretty unnerving about the ways that this can play out if it's not regulated and if it's completely unchecked. Like anything else, everything can be, you know, it can be a weapon or it can be something of value. It depends on how you interact with it and how you use it. It's like everything else in the world is going to have a lot to do with the intention of those whose hands it's in.
Yes. Well, you know, some people are using it to write their love letters and actually have...
their love endearing. That's interesting. That's the idea of offshooting human emotion too is really interesting, because what does it mean then if you're able to use something supplementally to be able to articulate something you struggle to say?
But the struggle is the beauty. The struggle is
right. Or the struggle is the human. That's exactly what it is. It's the that's the element of it that makes it the part that it's supposed to kind of be a struggle.
So, you know, your writing is also very much rooted to these places where you've lived, to the landscapes where you've loved and lost sometimes these homes you cannot return to. As you think about the beauty and wonder of the natural world and perhaps some of the environmental destruction that you see in talking about these wars, what are your memories of the beauty and wonder of the natural world and how do you find inspiration there?
It's interesting because in rewriting this, which I guess is a way of rewriting the memory of it, I found myself revisiting certain sites that I go to often, either in dream or in memory or in retelling. And they, so many of them took place in Lebanon, which is a place that I lived for almost a decade, but in a pretty influential part of my life. So like or time in my life, so like high school and college. And I don't think I realized how much the Mediterranean, how profoundly linked it was to my upbringing. And that's, it's interesting because I'm not someone, I'm actually quite afraid of the ocean and I don't really swim in it. And I'll like kind of go in like up to my thigh and just splash around and whatever. But that there, it is the backdrop of almost every formative memory I have during that era. And I think there is, and also like, you know, where I went to high school and sort of the mountain regions in Lebanon. And I think I spent a lot more time, if not in nature, because I've never camped, right? I think I've always thought of myself as very much someone that's embedded in cities. The telling of these stories and in writing them down, it was interesting because, you know, a memoir is different than a novel, but you're still having to do some degree of like character, you know, analysis and also like setting. You're having to think about setting. And it was astonishing how much setting took place in places, if not in nature, at least adjacent to it, you know, how much of it connected to, and also of nature in imagination. So like thinking about, in particular in Palestine, like how much time I spend thinking about places that I have never been or eras in which I've never been of those places, imagining my parents, my grandparents, my great-grandparents in places that I haven't had access to. And so like land, I write in the book and I've written about this elsewhere about how I feel like I forget about land a lot. And that actually feels like very much part of the Palestinian condition is like, you are sort of, it's not just similar to other indigenous movements where it's like you are actually kind of dislocated from land, kind of by design, and then you're made to feel outside of it. But it's funny how it still finds a way to sneak back in these really glorious ways. And so even though I like to tell a story of myself as being somebody not connected to land or not connected to nature or in exile from it, it's still remarkably present in all of my fiction, all of my poetry, and certainly this book.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, it's imprinted on us and it's through ancestors, through generations, and it comes up in our dreams and in your art and your writing. So thank you, Hala Alian, for sharing your journey to motherhood and telling these stories about love and longing, memory and loss, leaving and coming home. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Ian Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Natalie McCarthy with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sam Myers and Natalie McCarthy. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Associate text editor was Natalie McCarthy. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thank you for listening.